Okay, today's date is June 25th, 2015. It is 11:14. I am Destiny Griffin, the interviewer. The oral historian is Frey Royal. And this project is titled Oral Historians on Plant Closing in Milwaukee. Okay, so I first just want to start off by asking you where you were born and raised, and where the names of your parents and your siblings.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My father was Fred Royal Sr. My mother was Alexandria Royal. I have the oldest sister, Roberta, and the middle child, as she likes to be referred to, Dawn Marie. And of course, myself, Fred Royal Jr., being the youngest of the three.
Okay, and what were the occupations of your parents?
My father was a machinist at Ladish. My mother was a nurse's aide at Milwaukee County Health Behavior. They used to call it rehab. It was the health division out of Milwaukee County. It used to be Doane County Hospital.
Okay, what was your home like?
What was my home like?
Yeah. Where did you grow up, and it was
well?
Small?
The first home that I lived in when I was born was on Tetonia, 2636 North Tetonia, right across from Greater Galilee. We lived there until approximately. I turned the age of 6 or 7. Then we moved to 3045 North 23rd Street by our avenue, where we stayed until I was 11. At 11, we moved over to 1924 West Congress.
Okay. What was your religion, or what is your religion? And did you guys attend church or?
Okay. As growing up, my father never required us to go to church. He felt that your religious practice should be something that you wanted to do. He grew up in a very religious family, and he felt that that should be a personal choice, and always let us exercise that choice. Now my older sister, she kind of was required to attend church earlier from what I can remember when she was growing up. But we were never required to go to church every Sunday.
Okay. What were some family activities that you guys did, or just on holidays, or just fun things, sports?
Certainly. My father was a Mason, so we had a lot of interactions with the Masonic Order, and they would host picnics. That was some of the earliest memories that I had, is we always had an annual picnic with the Masons. But just growing up, our family, the family nucleus was, we were always doing barbecues, getting together on the holidays. One of my uncles, Harold Jackson, back in the 60s, 68, he purchased a plot of land out on 68th and Brown Deer when there were still restrictive covenants in the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County. He had his European-American co-worker, they were working at Square D at the time, purchased the land. And him and my father and the rest of my uncles constructed the house that was on the land because they couldn't hire contractors. But that was like a little getaway that I would often go to in the summer, and I would stay out there quite frequently and play out in Brown Deer with my cousin Dwayne.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like us to know about your childhood?
Pretty normal, in my opinion, you know, two-parent household. What was, I didn't know at the time, was unique was that my mother's Mexican and grew up in an interracial home, but to me it was normal. It was, you know, it wasn't an issue.
When did you realize she was Mexican?
Well, I knew she was Mexican, but I didn't think it was anything, yeah. You know, out of the ordinary. I think, it really wasn't an issue growing up. I think it was later, after I was grown, that she had told me an incident that had occurred with her where she was discriminated, where she was made to feel uncomfortable by not being served at, or being served with an attitude at one of the local restaurants because of her color, because of her heritage. But, you know, when we would frequent, there were some of our relatives on my mother's side that weren't as receptive as others to interracial relationship. But yeah, I guess so. It could have been, you know, early on that I knew that there was tensions because my mother was Mexican and married an African American man. But it wasn't a big issue.
Okay. Can you name your grade schools through high schools that you attended?
Yeah, the first grade school I attended was Iowa Avenue. From Iowa Avenue, I went to Garden Homes. Garden Homes and went to Rufus King.
Okay. What was your favorite subjects?
Math.
And any school activities?
I swam. Actually, I lettered in swimming. My nickname was Shorty in high school. I was about 4'11", 97 pounds. So swimming was kind of the only sport that I could feel comfortable doing. I managed wrestling, but I'd never gotten to that. A little bit too physical for me.
Did you attend college?
Later. Actually, I did not complete high school. I dropped out and got a GED because I felt that I wasn't learning life skills. I wasn't learning skills that were going to attain some kind of economic viability, and that's what I was looking for at that age. I wanted some money. I wanted to make some money, and I felt like reading, writing, arithmetic I had mastered already, and I had participated in the work study program, going to school half a day and working at General, I believe it was Wisconsin Gas Company at the time, because one of the other subjects that I was good in was drafting, and I got a work study grant or program that they had where I went to school half a day, because I was relatively smart kid, you know, had a 3.4, 3.5 average. And I was allowed to go to school half part-time and work the other part-time. And I was bored with that work study because it was a very menial task. We were putting in where the gas main would be in subdivisions. It was, very tedious, extremely tedious. So I got disenchanted with that, and like I said, my senior year I dropped out, went down to MATC and got my GED, and by that fall, that September of 1975, I was in the service. I was in the Air Force. I had enlisted.
Why did you want to join the Air Force?
Well, it was one of the branches that was always the furthest away from the front line. I wanted to get the benefits, but I did not want to risk my life to receive those benefits. It was some dumb, not plum dumb.
Is there anything else that you would like us to know about your educational history?
Like I said, up until that point, I had dropped out of school, went back to school later on in life and received two degrees, one in associate's degree in paralegal from MATC and a bachelor's degree from Cardinal Stretch in political science.
Okay. Are you married?
Been married to Darlene Royal for the last 38 years.
Alright. Do you have children?
Two sons, 138, 136, five grandchildren. Both my sons have completed 4 years in the Navy. Both are working, both are married, both live in Milwaukee.
All right. You just answered my next question. Do you have family activities with your children?
Oh, just, it's a continuation of the way that I was brought up. Every holidays we find family activities to get around and find some good food to consume.
That's always a good time. anything else you would like us to know about your family?
To me, that's the most important thing in life. That's the nucleus. That's what keeps you grounded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're gonna talk about your work information. We're gonna try to keep it in order.
Mm-hmm.
So, as an adult, what was your first job?
Ooh. After coming out of the service, I look at the service as being my first job. That kind of gave me direction, learning how to get there to where you need to be on time punctually. After I got out of the service, I think I started working for temp services. I finally got my first real job working in the warehouse for GE Medical off of 2nd and Edgerton. Worked there for, I want to say, maybe 18 months. And then I was afforded an opportunity to drive a truck for GE Medical. And on the anniversary of my wedding, I went to a jewelry store in Bayshore. At the time, it was called Orange Blossom. And I was going to surprise my wife with the first wedding ring, because we got married, we were extremely poor, and we did $35 at the church, at the courthouse. And there wasn't any ring or anything, but I had finally got this job, had some money, and some credit, went over to Orange Blossom. And I was in the company's truck, unfortunately. I was on the company's time doing this. And I was coming through, I think it's Lincoln Park, and there was a bridge that the truck didn't fit up under. So needless to say, that was my last day of working at General Electric. I had kind of damaged the truck pretty severely. And my father was a union representative, international representative for IAM District 10 that represented General Electric Medical. So he was quite upset that I had not only lost my job, but caused him some embarrassment also by damaging their property, doing things that I was supposed to do on company time.
Okay, we're going to move on to plant closings and the effects of that. So you worked with General Motors, right?
Yeah, after leaving GE Medical, I got a couple of menial jobs, through the contacts that my father had and his past, experience at Lattice, where he did retire from. But as I stated, he was very involved with the union at Lattice, and was promoted from shop steward to a district rep, international district rep for IAM, which is the machinist union. And he got me employment at Ladish back in 78, 79. In the first 30 days I worked at Ladish, I got my finger caught in a clamp that had a 400-pound flange. These are just, if you know anything about a forge shop, especially Ladish, they heat up titanium, the hardest metal known to man, in furnaces, blast furnaces, until it's a white ore, and then they basically hammer it to various shapes. So I was working in a grinding department, Bay 16, and there was this 400-pound flange, and it was, you pick it up with a clamp, and the clamp is hoisted like with the electric motor. Well, my finger got caught in the clamp, in the middle, in the corner of the clamp. So I was, the first 30 days, I had this finger basically fractured. So I went out on medical for that. When I returned, I was working in the grinding with a 60. We basically ironed out imperfections from the metal. When you hammer this metal, you get little wrinkles of imperfections. So you take a 16-pound stone and you grind out those imperfections. Well, that 16-pound grinding stone is connected to an engine that's 440 volts in a free spinning cord. The cord froze, slapped me across the chest, and I released the grinding stone. It cut my right leg and broke my left leg. So while I was in a cask mending, I said, this isn't for me, and I started going to Big Step. At the time, it was on Martin Luther King and Burleigh. At that time, it was 3rd Street and Burleigh, 3rd and Burleigh, and Vince Turan was the director. And Vince recognized my math ability and asked me one day, big time, if you want a job. And I said, yeah. So he took me out to Delphi Electronics, 7929 South Howell Avenue, and completed out the application and was supposed to be back at Delphi the next day for an orientation. I didn't tell Mr. Turan that I didn't have transportation to get back out there. And I was staying on 19th and Nash, right off of Tonya and Nash at that time. And so I got on a 10-speed bicycle the next day and got out there, and changed my life. And I retired from Delphi Electronics in 2009. Okay.
Did you like working there? You said it changed your life. So.
It was from Delphi Electronics had two divisions that were located in that facility. One made catalytic converters. And that's an automotive, their automotive parts industry. And the catalytic converter side, which I started on that August of 79, I thought I had, stepped in from leaving Ladish. It was like night and day. It was much cleaner, much quieter, parts were much lighter, much safer work environment. Loved it. That December, Bob Anderson called us all into the cafeteria and had a meeting and informed us that we were laid off. We would be laid off that Christmas. Fortunately, by May of 1980, we got picked up on the other side, the ENS side, which is the electronics and safety side of Delphi, which made engine control, body control modules for automobiles. And it was the cleanest plant that I had ever seen in my life, most highly automated plant that I have ever worked in my life. So it was like, you know, to me, from leaving Laddish, where you were beating white, hot white iron core metal into shapes and iron it with a 16-pound grinding stone, and to add injury to insult, so you got all this smoke from molten steel. Mm-hmm. Well, when the EPA had the tightening of the air pollution control laws, all Laddish did was close the chimney stack and kept the smoke inside. And if you wanted, you could ask for a respirator to keep the dust particles from being breathed in and in your nostrils and your mouth. But you're talking about a plant that when it was 70 degrees outside, it was about 110 degrees inside. So, yeah, it was like, you know, dying and going to heaven. That's the only thing that I could compare the two jobs with.
So when you got laid off, or when you were aware that you were going to get laid off, and you said you picked up the other job, was that right away, or did it leave a bad effect on your...
Which layoff?
With the better job that you were talking, with the...
In between Delphi's position? No, we had no idea whether we were going to be picked up or not. But, you know, you had unemployment, so it wasn't as if that there was great panic at that time. And I hadn't... My standard of living hadn't increased that dramatically, where I was really concerned about making my bills.
Okay. So then, you said it wasn't long until you were picked up at the other job.
At the other, yeah.
And how long were you at that one?
Now that was that's the job that I retired from. I was there from 1980 until 2009. Actually 2006. It was extremely profitable business for Delphi Automotives. But in 1990, General Motors spun Delphi off from the corporation, and it became its own subsidiary, its own entity, profitable business, no debt, plenty of cash reserves in the bank. It was the largest auto supplier in the world, still is. But I believe it was 9 years after that, so 1999, they filed bankruptcy and went under bankruptcy protection. And during that time, they constructed a plant in China and one in India while they were under bankruptcy. The reason that Delphi Electronics filed bankruptcy was to try and get from up under their legacy costs. And legacy costs are their pension and health benefits that they had promised individuals over the years of the contracts that we had negotiated. Delphi's workforce had an agreement with United Auto Workers, and that was our bargaining agent, which I was a member of. So it came out later that the COO, CFO, had cooked the books and did some other illegal activity as far as transferring funds and the way they set up this alleged bankruptcy, and they actually went to jail. So after the bankruptcy, there was a contract that was negotiated that to ease some of the, and this was prior to the indictment on the COO and CFO. these financial irregularities hadn't come to light yet. So there were negotiations to reduce the costs, the overhead costs, and the union tried to assist Delphi in coming out of bankruptcy in a favorable manner. So they put in a two-tier work system, and all the new hires would come in making $16.50 an hour. Now, the folks that had legacy, that had tenure, individuals like myself, we were averaging anywhere from $30 to $35 an hour. So we had this two-tier work pay scale, wage scale in plan, and these new employees, the new hires, they didn't have the same health care nor pension plans that the seasoned workforce, the workforce that I was covered under, had. So there was a little, you know, tension right there from the beginning. But it was a strategy that the UAW felt that would assist Delphi in coming out of bankruptcy in a stronger position. Like I said, this was in not knowing that they had manufactured this entire bankruptcy and that there was some pending indictments coming down. So around 2006, we went into another negotiations. And in 2006, they had announced the plant closing, but there were certain provisions for people that had 24 years of seniority or more, that you would go out with half of your pay, so you would, in essence, be paid $16.50 an hour to sit at home, and you would accrue seniority, meaning your seniority would continue to go to accrue until you reached your 30 years of seniority, and then you would be transferred into pension. You get your full pension. Now, our international union negotiated one of the best severance package I've ever seen acquired for a workforce. We retained our medical, our dental, our vision, and our full pension. Unfortunately, management, who worked there with us, alongside of us for 30 years, some had 40 years seniority. One lady named Kathy Michaels, she had more seniority than I had years of on this earth when that plant closed, and all they received was 6 months severance package, and that was it. No health, no dental, no vision. And it was pretty devastating on some of the management. It was pretty devastating on a lot of the hourly too. I was the vice president at the time that the international was negotiating these severance packages, and we were going to Detroit, and we were allowed to sit in on some of the negotiations. They were asking our opinion and if giving them permission to negotiate what they were negotiating. As I said, United Auto Workers is one of the most progressive, one of the most intelligent unions I've ever worked for. But people would come up to me after I come back from these meetings and ask, you know, am I going to be all right? Are they going to take care of me?
You answered those questions.
I want to finish.
Okay.
Because some people actually either drank themselves to death. We've had high incidents of domestic abuse when we were going through this period. Plant closings are devastating. The impact on a person's life is not pretty.
Okay, to wrap things up, I want to talk about, because now you're the president of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
What made you want to get a part of that?
I didn't want to be the president. I was content with being one of the soldiers in the background. James Hall, who had became president, challenged the Hamiltons for the presidency of the NAACP 4 years ago. I had a relationship with him by working with him at SDC, where I was the chairman of the board of that commission for 2 years. And he just felt that I had the ability to continue to lead in the direction in which he had taken the organization, and asked if I would run for that seat. And for some reason, the other individuals who were interested in running, for one reason or other, were disqualified. So I didn't even have to run for the seat. I mean, basically de facto election. I was the only person qualified to be on the ballot. God puts you where he wants you.
How long have you been the president?
6 months.
Do you think that you're going to continue to go on?
No, I don't anticipate running for re-election. It's an extremely challenging position. It's challenging in the sense that you have to not only deal with the issues that confront us in our community, which are those we know of. The challenge is keeping the lights on for the organization, raising funds, because we don't do programming, we don't have a dedicated funding stream. That's the biggest challenge. And it's hard to take money from an entity and then potentially have to turn around and publicly humiliate them for them not doing what they should be doing by law as far as inclusion and hiring practices. So I don't want to be that type of individual that can't work effectively because I'm dependent on corporate sponsorship. Mm-hmm. So keeping the lights on is the biggest challenge.
Well, that's all I have.
Please. You talked about people losing their lives, drinking themselves to death. Could you expound on that a little bit more? Do you know any specific people that?
I don't remember their names, but I remember we talked to, you know, you pick up the phone and you talk to some of your ex coworkers and they tell you, you know, so and so they drank themselves to death. And some of them had drinking problems prior to the plant closing, but the plant closing just exacerbated it. It increased the amount of time that you had on your hands to do nothing but drink. And you got to remember, most of these individuals that worked in at Delphi, a lot of them came straight from high school. They had no other work experience. They had no other identity. That job was their identity. That was who they were. And that was the concerns that people would ask me when I come back from the meetings in Detroit, is that, you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do after this? But, you know, I was fortunate in the sense that I had been going to school during the time. Part of our benefits was tuition reimbursement, and I had been utilizing them. But nationwide, out of the 36,000 employees Delphi had, when they filed bankruptcy, only 600 were utilizing tuition reimbursement.
Wow. Do you know any people whose kids had to drop out of college or weren't able to pay their bills or their insurance as a result?
Well, fortunately, insurance, we received insurance. But here's the thing that most people don't truly take a full appreciation for is that when your standard of living is at $32 an hour, $50,000 a year, or based on overtime, maybe $75,000 a year, and then all of a sudden you're reduced to $16.50, mm-hmm. $32,000, $36,000 a year, your bills don't get reduced.
Right.
So you still have a challenge of making ends meet even more so because over the course of 20, 25 years, you've come accustomed to living a lifestyle at from $50,000 to $70,000 a year, and then all of a sudden you're at 32. So there's a lot of anxiety, that's placed on that individual of how to make those ends meet.
I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's